This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. As President Obama says, the U.S. will take action on election hacking by Russia. New Hampshire's presidential electors, meanwhile, have already called for an investigation. Senator Jeanne Shaheen wants to review whether President-elect Trump's national security advisor should get a security clearance. And New Hampshire Secretary of State is targeting two city clerks for their efforts to modernize election technology. That and some grim news on drug overdose deaths. But if you want to smoke marijuana in Massachusetts, go ahead and always join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477, email at exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning. It's a weekly news roundup. Joined this week by Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, Ellen Nelson, Concord Monitor, and Casey McDermott from here at NHPR. All right, let's start with Russia. Far from a local story, but definitely some local angles to it. The electors' letter to National Intelligence Director James Clapper, which was signed by 9 Democrats and 1 Republicans nationally, but all 4 of New Hampshire's electors, says, among other things, quote, "We further require a briefing on all investigative findings as these matters directly impact the core factors in our deliberations of whether Mr. Trump is fit to serve as president," unquote. That's what they say. What do you make of this, David? Is this just how much of this is electoral politics? How much of this is legitimate concerns?
The individuals involved have legitimate concerns and are weighing in on the issue as part of their personal beliefs, but also reflecting the fact that Clinton won New Hampshire, and they are in large part reflecting a line of thought very predominant in the Clinton camp, and I'm sure we'll hear more of it from President Obama in his press conference.
Yes. New Hampshire's electors, it ought to be noted, Carol Shea Porter, Bev Hollingworth, Terry Norelli, and Dudley Dudley are Democrats. Hillary Clinton did carry New Hampshire, and in part they were chosen because they were first women in New Hampshire to hold various electoral posts, executive counsel in Dudley Dudley's case, a Senate president for Bev Hollingworth, House Speaker for Terry Norelli, and member of Congress for Carol Shea Porter. And clearly they were elected, chosen for that, but there was a certain sort of symbolism there. Dudley Dudley was a Sanders supporter early on, but staunch Clinton now. I don't believe there's any other state where all the electors signed this letter. Do you think this foretells an attitude by Democrats nationally as well as in New Hampshire, kind of a get-tough attitude on Donald Trump? I mean, we can see Jeanne Shaheen stepping out with Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut to question retired General Michael Flynn getting top security clearance. Casey.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've heard from Senator Shaheen so far, I think a little bit of, what little we've heard from Governor, soon-to-be Senator-elect Maggie Hassan, does foretell at least a little bit of resistance on their part, I think, to the new administration. I think that both of them have said that they're interested in, perhaps finding common ground on the issue of opioid abuse or other issues that might be, of particular local significance to New Hampshire. But in general, I think that we can probably expect the two of them to, continue to kind of put up a fight or at least stand firm against the Trump administration or Republican control in Congress otherwise.
And it is interesting that the Trump folks are, as you might expect, taken aback a little bit by some of this. Why don't we hear what one of his state co-chairmen, Steve Stepanek, had to say this week?
They lost, and now they're crying in their milk. They won't accept it, and they're trying to turn around and come up with some way to somehow delegitimize the election, and they are just crybabies.
All right, that was Steve Stepanek, one of Donald Trump's state co-chair people talking on WMUR. He says people raising questions about Russian hacking and whether or not it sort of cast doubt on anything in the election are crybabies. This is largely a national matter, but this did trickle down into state races as well. The hacking, this emerged in the first congressional district race between Carol Shea Porter and Frank Ginta. And that was reported in the summer, but Ali, you had a story this week that kind of looked at the backstory of that. What did you learn?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my curiosity was piqued after I read it, one of a couple of New York Times investigations into Russia's alleged involvement and hacking in over the summer in the election. And I talked to William Tucker, a Seacoast-based liberal blogger who blogs under Misleading Blue. And he actually had corresponded with a hacker called Guccifer 2.0 to get a kind of trove of leaked documents pertaining to the DCCC, and gives funding and support to congressional candidates. And one of the things that he had uncovered was that there was, some kind of internal discussion among DCCC officials that Carol Shea Porter maybe was not the best person to take on Frank Ginta, and that they were interested in having Chris Pappas, who's an executive counselor, possibly take that spot. Ultimately, it didn't really prove to be super damaging to Carol Shea Porter, who still narrowly won her race in New Hampshire. But it was just sort of part of this larger national issue.
And hands on the scale by Democratic leaders.
Exactly.
And sort of on a piece with the
And just sort of embarrassing leaks on the Democratic side, and that was sort of by these Russian hackers.
Yeah, it was interesting. I remember talking to Carol Shea Porter during the campaign about this, and she had a ready response, which was true in that she has never really been the choice of party insiders stretching back from. I mean, now she is in New Hampshire certainly, but stretching back to when she first ran back then. In 2006, the DCCC had essentially anointed Jim Craig, who was then a New Hampshire House member, now Labor Commissioner, as their choice. They got involved in the primary, and I can recall on that primary night actually being at Jim Craig's headquarters as it became clear that he wasn't going to win. The steam table was getting no action, and all of a sudden people were, reporters were kind of putting on their coats to make their way to Shea Porter's campaign headquarters. And so she's, she kind of wears this, as a point of pride in a
right.
way that she hasn't been the choice. But, the idea that Russian hacking is getting deep into, parochial congressional races is certainly something that, has gotten the attention of people on Capitol Hill as well. And
sure.
the calls for investigations there aren't simply Democrats, although in addition to her call for the review of General Michael Flynn's security clearance over him sharing classified information with British and Australian military officers in Afghanistan, which was investigated. He was sort of informally reprimanded. She also is looking for an investigation of Russian hacking more broadly. Why don't we listen to what Jean Shaheen had to say this week on that front to NH1.
I'm pleased to see that the Senate is finally responding. I called for a hearing on this issue back in September before the elections. I think it would have been helpful to do that then. But in any case, I think it's important to do it now. This is a bipartisan issue. We can't afford to have any country, particularly a country that has been as aggressive and antagonistic to the United States as Putin's Russia has been, to allow them to get away with interfering in our elections and not take any response.
And so, David, as you mentioned, we're going to hear from President Obama this afternoon on this, presumably. What do you make of Jean Shaheen's role here?
Much like the New Hampshire electors, she is, I'm sure, expressing a sincere personal belief of her own, but also playing her part in what is a strong party initiative to just keep this issue front and center of Russian hacking of the election. And as chance would have it, New Hampshire once again rises to the top of the political agenda with the fact that we have reports of the hacking actually trying to influence a New Hampshire race. We have New Hampshire electors weighing in on it where other states, most other states' electors have not. And we have the state's congressional delegation front and center on the issue that the Democrats at this point think they really have a winner on, because they're convinced that if the CIA says it has convincing evidence, it has it. And that in some fashion, the Trump administration is eventually going to have to roll back on this.
All right. Tell us what you think. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Are you concerned by reports of Russian hacking? Do you agree with President Obama that the United States should take action? Do you share the view of some of the Trump supporters that this is essentially amounts to sour grapes from Democrats who didn't get their candidate elected? Join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You know, I will say it would be interesting to watch Jeanne Shaheen in the Senate. She hasn't been in the Senate with a Republican president, and to see what sort of role she plays as part of the resistance to a Trump presidency is going to be interesting to see. Casey, what do you see issues on which she may take a hard line on?
I think, again, like we said, like the issue of opioid crisis, the opioid crisis in New Hampshire is probably one where she's going to try to find common ground. I could see the Democratic representatives from New Hampshire across the board really digging in their heels when it comes to the Affordable Care Act and the future of that, particularly given the extent to which Medicaid expansion has been touted by them and, particularly by the governor as a success story here in New Hampshire. And that's also something where I would think that the governor, once she is senator, is going to be eager to go down to Washington and point to what New Hampshire did as an example of where Republicans and Democrats can find common ground on the issue of health care, because our Medicaid expansion was the product of a lot of kind of deal making between the Republicans and her. So I think that's probably going to be a big area where we would see her kind of taking a hard line stance down there.
All right. Why don't we go to the phones? Chris is on the line from Nashua. Good morning, Chris. Go ahead. Chris, are you there? Okay. We'll go to Chris in a moment. Certainly the Affordable Care Act is likely to be, you can see Democrats rallying around the numbers that came out last week showing the number of people who were added to the insurance rolls under so-called Obamacare. And, I think it was 64,000 people in New Hampshire.
Yeah, about 63,000, I think, was the total. And the insured or the uninsured rate here is supposedly down, I think, 43% from when the law first took effect. So I think those, among other numbers around, the number of people who have been covered through the Medicaid expansion and otherwise, are definitely statistics that we're going to be hearing a lot of in the months ahead.
All right. Why don't we return to Chris in Nashville. Chris, are you there? Good morning. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. So in regards to the question about am I concerned about Russian hacking, the answer is absolutely yes, because the entire credibility of elections rests on, the people believing that the right person was elected and it was done fairly. And this has completely interjected an element that we shouldn't have. And it's alarming that there's a partisan nature to this at all now. I mean, we should be looking for, whatever the facts were, wherever they may lead us. But even more than that, as if that was unfortunately not concerning enough, we have this ridiculous partisanship coming from Trump and Governor-elect Sununu, where they are questioning, the credibility of the election and so on, and they're vowing to roll back early voting and same-day registration because presumably there's this massive voter fraud, which they cannot prove, will never prove, because it never happened, but they want the issue more than they want the truth.
And so what are your own politics, Chris? Are you a Democrat, Republican, Independent?
I'm an independent. I used to be a Republican. I'm no longer a Republican, but I can't say that I'm a Democrat. And the thing that concerns me is, everything gets turned into some kind of partisan issue, and we've completely lost any sense of common sense.
All right, thank you.
Really upsetting.
Thank you, Chris. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Obviously, this is going to be interesting to see where this goes. There are plenty of Republicans on Capitol Hill who believe that this hacking needs to be investigated. Prominent Republicans, John McCain's one of them. Mitch McConnell has also suggested support for some form of investigation. What the president decides to do, he said this morning on NPR that, the United States is going to take action, when it chooses. Obviously, the president doesn't have a heck of a lot more time for the action to take place on his watch. So I guess, we're obviously in the dark about what's going to come down the pike on that front. But, why don't we leave Russia for a minute, and we will stick, though, with a form of electoral mechanics and intrigue of a far more local variety. I guess the specter of hacking does loom over this in some fashion as well, and that's the tension between New Hampshire's top election official, Secretary of State Bill Gardner, and some city clerks over election technology. Casey, you've been digging into this. What have you learned?
Yeah, so I should start by saying that this is a relatively unusual move on the Secretary of State's part, and I think that the Secretary of State's office acknowledges that their decision to file records requests against two city clerks is relatively unprecedented. Basically, what happened is that the Secretary of State's office sent letters to the city clerks in Manchester and Laconia at the end of November, asking them to turn over a bunch of records and communications as it relates to e-poll books. And those are electronic poll books. So basically, the voter checklists that people are used to seeing whenever they arrive at the polls on Election Day in New Hampshire that are used to check voters in. Right now, all of that is done on paper. There was a pilot that went forward actually in both of the last two legislative sessions to roll out an electronic version. But the one that was brought forward this year was one that would have rolled that out in three towns during the state primary. And the Secretary of State's office was not in favor of that. They had a number of concerns about getting the technology ready in time for the primary and also just had concerns about the way that the proposal was presented. But on the other hand, the proposal had the backing of a lot of clerks across the state, a number of legislators on both sides of the aisle, because people see this as a way to not only kind of streamline the check-in process and also make life easier on the clerks that have to, you know, then spend hours and weeks and sometimes months after the election updating the lists that are done kind of, you know, by hand, line by line on paper right now. But it's also a way for people who are concerned about kind of the integrity of the voting process. This has been pitched as a technology that will allow the lists to update in real time. So, for example, if you have someone who tries to vote in one ward and then goes to try to vote in another ward, the system hypothetically would be able to know that right away. So that would maybe eliminate some of those concerns. But anyway, the request asked for a bunch of communications and was spurred actually in part as a response to a request that the state received from this outside advocacy group called America Votes. It's a left-leaning progressive group that does a lot of work in the area of kind of voting rights and voting access. And the Secretary of State's office say they have a reason to believe that, like, these city clerks were somehow involved in that. The city clerks deny it and say that they think it's kind of bizarre that, like, they would be drawn into
this.
So it's a lot of layers here.
Involving the Secretary of State's office can get. David, you know, this is also, you know, I think the first reporting on this was in your paper.
Yeah.
And, you know, does this strike you as kind of Bill Gardner being Bill Gardner and being,
There's a little territoriality to the whole situation. I mean, stepping back from the specifics of the technology, attempts to digitize the activity or conduct of the elections in New Hampshire have been, in many ways, very difficult to get through Mr. Gardner. He's very protective of the franchise, and there's a tone in this whole situation that seems to suggest that these municipalities dared to attempt to introduce digital technology into the election process of New Hampshire without the sanction of the Secretary of State, and now they will pay. And this is just not sitting well at the local level, because there's no evidence any harm has come from this, and there's no convincing case that it is anything but an improvement in the technology. So there's a very little conclusion to draw from this on the sidelines, except that the Secretary of State was not entirely comfortable with the proposition.
All right. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange.org. More weekly New Hampshire News Roundup after a break here on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, Ellen Nilsen, Concord Monitor, and Casey McDermott from here at NHPR. Now, we were talking about the tension between some city clerks and the Secretary of State's office over discussions, really, about how to modernize our election system. Is this something, Casey, that we will be expecting legislation on?
I think that, well, the Secretary of State's office is anticipating legislation. They said that's part of the reason why they filed their request. I talked to Deputy Secretary of State Dave Scanlon, and he said that they're basically trying to arm themselves with information about what kind of conversations were taking place about last year's proposal, because they think that it's going to come up again and they want to be, you know, fully informed, I guess. But I do think that we are likely to see a number of Governor-elect Sununu has made it clear that he's anticipating a lot of movement on voting issues, maybe not voting technology. That might not be in his kind of purview whenever he's talking about it. But I think that this is something that we are likely to see more of. I think, you know, I would be surprised if this whole back and forth doesn't maybe embolden some of the clerks who feel passionately about this to maybe, you know, speak out or continue to speak out about why they feel like this is an important issue, because it was something that they talked about a lot last year, too. And I do think it's important, because we didn't, I don't know if we necessarily made this clear before, but it is important to note that the two city clerks who are being targeted in this records request also happen to be ones that have spoken out openly about their desire to see a more proactive approach from the Secretary of State's office. So, you know, they're not the only ones who were lobbying on the e-poll books, but they happen to be ones who have been particularly vocal about wanting to see changes.
Well, particularly when it comes to getting bills passed in the New Hampshire House, historically, you know, city and town clerks can be a pretty persuasive bunch when they work in concert, you know, as can the Secretary of State. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch as election law issues are front and center this session, the degree to which, you know, what Bill Gardner decides he wants comes to pass.
Well, I think, too, because like the town clerks at the end of the day are part of the constituencies of a lot of legislators. So there's kind of this, I think what we see sometimes at the State House around election issues is there is a lot of deference to the Secretary of State's office, because Secretary of State Gardner is, you know, rightfully to some extent seen as an expert on voting issues, given
it's his 21st
long
term.
Exactly. Yeah. So. But if you also have people on the other side of issues who might be bringing a different perspective based on what they're seeing on the ground, and if those people also happen to be your constituents in the communities that you're representing, then I think that could potentially create situations where some lawmakers would be divided between those two sides.
All right. Well, that's certainly going to be something to watch. Another issue that is going to be something to watch, particularly in light of developments in Massachusetts, where you can now legally smoke marijuana, and in Maine, where a referendum is under recount, you know, will be marijuana. One proposal that's that the Senate Minority Leader Jeff Woodburn says he's going to push is something that would you know, allow for essentially, he's open minded about what form it takes, but I mean, he's looking at legal marijuana here in New Hampshire. Why don't we take a listen to what he told our Morning Edition this week?
That New Hampshire should be on the forefront of defining what we want it to look like, how we're going to regulate it, how we're going to tax it, how we're going to distribute it. What is the process going to look like?
All right. That's Jeff Woodburn, Minority Leader, Senator from Dalton, speaking to Morning Edition this week. Ella, this is a topic you've been looking at as well. You know, from talking to people on this front, what do you think the appetite's going to be for, you know, among the public and also within the State House on this issue?
Yeah, well, I was honestly kind of surprised to hear. I think a lot of the debate has been about decriminalization in the past. So I was kind of surprised to hear Senator Woodburn, you know, jump so quickly from decriminalization to full-blown legalization. And I think that some of that in part might be driven by the recent referendums in neighboring Maine and Massachusetts, two states that have just passed marijuana legalization and are right on two sides of the New Hampshire border. You know, it's going to be a really interesting fight to see. I think that in New Hampshire, you know, we were one of the last states to pass or to instate a medical marijuana program, which is still, you know, kind of it's up and running now. But it took a while. It's still a little rocky. And so I think that, and I, you know, Governor Maggie Hassan had been opposed to this for a while. Governor-elect Chris Sununu has said that he would be open to decriminalization. I don't know if he would be so open to legalization. I think that he is more opposed to that. But it will be interesting to see sort of if the thinking has changed. But I think it would be kind of a dramatic shift for lawmakers if we saw more sort of support for this all of a sudden, especially given the fact that the state is, you know, very much still in the throes of an opioid and fentanyl crisis.
Well, that was one of the arguments that advocates for loosening marijuana laws will make, is that it would free up more resources to address opioids. Senator Woodburn also sees it as a lifestyle issue, that this might make New Hampshire putatively more attractive to young people. You know, there's, of course, the revenue aspect. And, you know, one of the things on the revenue front, and we certainly see this, you know, in the casino debate, is that the idea is that if you want revenue, you're better off being on the leading edge of these things than being a laggard. But it would be a change. Chris Sununu has been pretty clear that he does not favor out-and-out legalization. David, you've been watching this debate for a long time. Do you think we're in a moment where it's really going to be sort of changed quickly?
Well, supporters of this, like Rennie Cushing, think State Rep Rennie Cushing from Hampton, think they're at a moment where at least decriminalization has the best chance it's had in a long time, given the referendums in our neighboring states and the implications that has for marijuana availability, and the fact that there has been often in the past pretty good support for decriminalization in the House. The Senate's been the problem. We now have a governor that says he would support decriminalization. So that's a possibility. Legalization, I don't think, has got much of a prayer in New Hampshire in the immediate future. And the situation in Maine and New Hampshire, far from forcing the state's hand, has actually put Sununu in the position of being able to say, well, we should wait and see what happens in those two states. And that sounds like a convincing argument to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that is true. It's also be interesting to see if this changes. I mean, for Democrats, the notion of governors, the notion, I think, of being seen as soft on marijuana was something they feared as being rolled into a political message that they'd be soft on crime. It would upset the alliances that Governor Hassan and Governor Lynch had both developed with law enforcement. It's a slightly different equation with a Republican in the corner office.
But there is a strong libertarian faction within the Republicans, particularly in the House, that are very supportive.
Yes. We will see. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. As of yesterday, you can smoke marijuana in Massachusetts legally. They still have to wear seatbelts and motorcycle helmets down there. They have to have auto insurance. And they need to come up here to buy fireworks that merit that name, but they can smoke marijuana there. What does this mean for New Hampshire? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Why don't we turn to another drug topic that's a little more sobering, and that is the grim news on overdoses and on the confirmation that, you know, fentanyl has played a role in the overwhelming majority of these. Casey and Ali, you both looked at these numbers this week. Casey, what did the numbers tell you?
Yeah, it's pretty stunning. So far this year, we have seen at least 369 people who have fatally overdosed in New Hampshire. But the actual number could be higher. The medical examiner says that they have another almost 80 cases that are still under review from this year, and they're anticipating another record year in terms of the number that we're going to see by the year's end. But if you break down those figures, fentanyl was actually behind almost three quarters of those deaths. So that would be fentanyl on its own or fentanyl combined with, for example, heroin or other drugs. And if you look at on NHPR.org, we have a story up with a graph in there. And if you look at the trend lines over the last few years and when we started seeing these record years for drug overdoses in New Hampshire, the corresponding number of the total number of drug overdoses lines up with this huge spike in the presence of fentanyl. So I think it's safe to say that I think I've been trying to catch myself on this too, but I think often we refer to this as a heroin epidemic. But in fact, I think it's more an opioid epidemic or perhaps even a fentanyl epidemic at this point, just given what the data is telling us. And I think that this is something that we heard lawmakers try to address in the last year in terms of enacting stricter penalties for fentanyl distribution, things like that. And I would imagine that these latest figures are going to be more cause for concern and conversation around the state house.
But I mean, on a user level, if you're a opioid user out buying drugs on the street. Do you know
that you're getting it? Yeah, that's one of the things that's tricky about this is that they, like the police officers or first responders, often don't even know whether fentanyl was included in whatever.
And one's ability to test would be
it has to be done chemically at the state lab.
Yeah. I would say that in a lot of cases, people don't know what they're getting because drug manufacturers. I've talked to DEA agents who have gone and done busts in places like Lawrence, Mass. And they'll go into a house where somebody has a manufacturing fentanyl operation. And literally the mode of mixing up fentanyl and heroin is like cutting it, putting it in a blender and, just pressing blend. What people have said to me is that that doesn't actually blend the drug. So when it gets packaged, a lot of times, if you're lucky, you might get the less potent part of it. But sometimes you'll just get hit with straight fentanyl. But the other part of it is, some people don't know what they're using, but some people do seek this out because it is the strongest and could give them the most potent high. So that is the other part of that. But law enforcement now have to be very careful when they're dealing with fentanyl because of accidental overdoses if they come even in skin-to-skin contact with this drug because that is how potent it is. It can be very dangerous to law enforcement doing drug busts as well.
Why don't we return to the phones for a moment? Christina is on the line from Bedford. Good morning, Christina. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just want to voice my opinion to say that I've been smoking pot for 30 years. I do not believe in legalizing marijuana in the state of New Hampshire. I believe in decriminalizing it. Medical marijuana should be expanded probably to include pain management since a lot of people are on methadone for pain management. I have friends who've been on methadone. Pain management who would much prefer to smoke pot, works more effectively, less addictive, less side effects. We all know it's better. So I believe that pot has lots of good reasons for being available. I just don't think it should be legalized.
Why has it been smoking for 30 years, but why the hesitance when it comes to making it legal?
Well, I don't think that just making it so widely available on the street corner is a good thing. And my grower friends wouldn't appreciate it.
All right.
So, and alcohol, I think it's a far better intoxicant than alcohol. Certainly you can smoke a whole bag of pot and never die. You can drink a whole bottle of vodka and drop dead in a second.
So. All right, Christina, thank you for that bit of advice.
I do think we should just note that there are a lot of concerns out there while, Christina's points are taken in terms of marijuana's relative danger. Like there's a lot of unknown as far as other kind of THC edibles, and that's where a lot of the concerns come up often whenever you talk about legalization is the potency of those and the unknown effects that they may have on someone's system.
Sure. So. And setting up a marketing scheme and everything else is all an issue, which is why the movement tends to be more toward decriminalization because the police in the state have said on numerous occasions as the medical marijuana debate was underway, we don't waste time arresting street-level users. So if the law enforcement is just looking the other way on use as opposed to trafficking and so forth, then it speaks towards a decriminalization argument.
All right. Why don't we turn to another issue that surrounding drugs? There's a bill in on needle exchanges to deal with the opioid issue in a fashion, or at least the public health implications of IV drug use. That's something that was debated and failed last time. The lead sponsor of that bill last year did not get reelected, Joe Hannon out of Lee. Do you think that a sort of a harm reduction approach – you've done some reporting on this, Ella – that a harm reduction approach when it comes to opioids is something that, is likely to gain any political purchase in this atmosphere or not?
Well, I think that it'll be interesting to see, just given the fact that, you know, at least in the past couple of years, it doesn't seem I know that treatment options are expanding, recovery options are expanding, but, you know, we're still on track to hit around 500 fatal overdose deaths. And people often talk about the deaths, but I think you're right. I think the public health implications, there are many, many more public health implications that we're not talking about quite as much as the deaths, which are sort of staring you in the face more. But there are certainly, people are concerned about a potential rise in diseases like hepatitis C, which can be spread by using and sharing dirty needles, other serious problems. So I think that, you know, in talking to some people involved in public health, you know, there is a concern that, you know, maybe some harm reduction and harm mitigation when you have a problem on the scale that you do in New Hampshire with opioids is something that we need to take a look at.
All right. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email at exchange and NHPR. Why don't we talk about some of the bills that are coming down the pike? You know, one proposal you wrote about this week, David, was something from Ken Weiler, a longtime rep from Kingston, talking about an elected AG, which would actually require a constitutional change.
Ken makes the case that the attorney general should be elected by the state legislature, as is the case with the Secretary of State, for example. He feels that while he's brought up this argument in the past unsuccessfully, he has his best chance ever this year because of some of the controversies generated by the Attorney General's relationship with the state legislature in the past session, particularly where the Attorney General refused to defend in court the state's educational funding law against challenges by Bedford and Dover. He also has been unhappy over the decision by the previous attorney general to refuse to have New Hampshire join the other states in filing the lawsuit against Obamacare, even though a Republican legislature passed a resolution to that extent and so forth. He just feels the attorney general has become the representative of the governor. And to an extent, he says he thinks he should be representative of all the people. I think what he means is he should be more responsive to the state legislature.
Well, how many states do choose
only
the
one
legislature
or two.
By
only
that method?
Very small number.
There are few that are appointed. Many are elected. But in terms of being sort of
constitutional officer. I think 43 states elect by the voters the attorney general. Only two or three are they elected by the legislature. But this is a tough hill to climb. Constitutional amendments are extremely difficult to get through the legislature,
yes,
let alone attain the necessary majorities by the voters at large. So this is considered by many to be a long shot. But if nothing else, it might put any incoming attorney general on notice.
Sure. And that the governor, like Chris Sununu, will be selecting a new attorney general. That will be one of the first big appointments he will make after taking office. You know, you call this a long shot, David. At this time of year, there are a lot of long shot proposals out there for the legislature to contemplate. There are going to be lots of bills on lots of topics. Those are starting to get a little attention. Ella, you wrote about a topic area like election law is going to get a lot of attention, which is going to be tax issues. You know, what are we seeing in terms of we'll get to that after a break. Coming up, more New Hampshire news headlines on our weekly roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire news roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. So we were talking about some of the bills that are going to be coming down to the pike when the legislature gets back to work in earnest after the turn of the year. And taxes are something that's been a priority for Governor Sununu. It'll be interesting to see where he comes down on changing our tax system, if at all. Ella, you wrote about some of the proposals that are pending. What are lawmakers going to be pawing over?
Well, the biggest thing when it comes to taxes is sort of a continuation from the last budget session in 2014 is, business taxes and has sort of how much. It's safe to say that with a Republican-controlled legislature and a Republican governor that business taxes will probably go down. The question is just how much they will go down in the state. That was more of a fight when Governor Maggie Hassan was doing the 2014 or the 2015, I should say, budget. But so business taxes is the biggest thing to look out for. Again, the argument from Republicans generally or pro lowering business tax contingent is that it will help bring more business to the state and also help keep businesses in the state. That was sort of the only thing that Sununu ran on when it came to taxes. He certainly hasn't really proposed putting in any new taxes or fees. And as far as revenue goes,
you could redesign some of them in a way that might allow them to be considered more streamlined.
Sure.
and that sort of thing. And that's one thing that, people are going to be looking for, probably not in his inaugural address, but certainly by the time he has to present his budget, David.
Right.
I mean, what are you hearing on this front? I mean,
the business taxes, the next
wave they're going to go down.
Is locked in.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely going to happen. I don't think we'll see much other action on taxes in a Republican a dominated legislature with a Republican governor, other than continued implementing the second round of tax cuts for businesses. As far as pending legislation, I think there's some definites with the Republican majority. I don't think they're going to try to implement the entire ideological wish list of the Tea Party, as was the case, for instance, during the O'Brien speakership. I think right to work, which enables people to decline union dues and a bill to enable concealed carry of firearms without a permit, and some form of election reform are definites. What's the Democrats' bills on income tax and minimum wage are just not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And the one area that the Democrats might prevail, oddly enough, is the Gateway to Work program, a work training and workforce development program proposed by the governor that couldn't get out of the fiscal committee, will probably reemerge in some form so that the Republicans can claim credit for it in the next session.
So, Casey, what are you looking for in terms of issues? And you spent a lot of time covering Chris Sununu during the governor's race. And, he wasn't terribly explicit when it came to many specifics. But what are you imagining he will want to achieve in terms of meeting the goals of essentially a refreshed New Hampshire business environment?
I mean, I think one of the things that we heard from him a lot was the idea that New Hampshire, as he saw it, was a regulatory police state on the trail a few times. So I think the extent,
catchy.
Yeah. Once you unpack that, I think that it, gets to, peeling back regulations. He had this 90-day ban on rules and regulations that he floated during the campaign. I definitely will be looking to see whether that plays out and how that plays out and what kind of impact that might have on just kind of the day-to-day activities of various state agencies or operations. He also talked up this idea of visiting, I think, 100 businesses in his first 100 days in office, just from kind of acting as an ambassador for New Hampshire and trying to draw more people into the state to do business here. So to the extent that that might jumpstart the state's economy, I think that's kind of an open-ended question. And again, I think that it's going to be interesting to see how much emphasis he and the legislature put on this issue of workforce development, which is something that we hear over and over again from business owners, from people who are kind of following the economy in New Hampshire to kind of fill the gaps in the state's workforce that exist right now, because a lot of them are saying that they're actually having a problem with hiring skilled workers, not necessarily offering jobs to people, or it's not a matter of not having places for people to work.
I mean, workforce is definitely something he stressed. He's also stressed energy issues, and he spoke at the BIA's energy symposium, I guess now a week and a half ago, and he was talking about the need to drive down electric prices. You know, this is an area you've done a lot of reporting on, David.
Yeah.
You know, where do you see areas where, you know, you'd expect him to try to do something in terms of energy issues?
Well, it's very frustrating from the point of view of a political policymaker, because so much of the decisions regarding new energy infrastructure, which is largely viewed as part of the solution to lowering rates, are out of the hands of the state legislature and the governor's office, and largely determined by regulatory agencies like the Public Utility Commission and the Site Evaluation Committee, this sort of statewide planning board that rules on big energy projects. And, you know, these are somewhat independent of the political realm. So in terms of fostering improvement of the kind of new transmission and generation facilities that might address the pricing issue, there is not a lot of direct action the governor or the legislature can take. What they can do is pass laws that encourage the development of pathways for energy projects, that makes it easier to approve them in certain areas. They can influence the design of the committees that do have final say on these projects, which they've done in the past. But I think what they can do is use the bully pulpit. And I think we've seen Sununu, with his position on Northern Pass in particular, come out in a way for that very clearly in his position on that we haven't seen from previous governors.
In the speech that I saw him give to the Business and Industry Association, he said anyone who does not believe that New Hampshire doesn't need more natural gas is simply wrong. He said that for the right project, you know, he would get out and push for it. He has no problem trying to use whatever political leverage he has. And, you know, he will, to your earlier point, he will have a pick on the Site Evaluation Committee coming up pretty soon. But again, high energy prices have been a problem in New Hampshire for a long time. Right. You know, didn't get there quickly.
Well, the low-hanging fruit for a Republican-led legislature with a Republican governor, of course, is to eliminate what they consider are some of the surcharges on the electric bill that are designed to foster the development of renewables like solar and wind energy and our participation in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Alliance. All of these initiatives that foster renewables attack on a few extra fractions of a cent on the electric bill. And we know that the governor is not a big fan of the big-scale solar projects that are a big part of that charge. So we might see some effort to reduce the state's subsidy for renewable energies and have that framed in the context of lowering electric bills.
Well, on the energy front, I mean, the Antrim Wind Farm did win approval from the Site Evaluation Commission. Why don't we take a listen to what the CEO of Jack Kenworthy of Walden Green Energy, the company behind the wind project, had to say about what's going to happen.
This is good news. It's good news for New Hampshire. This is a project that's going to be able to bring significant amount of investment and clean energy and conservation benefits to this region.
All right. That was Jack Kenworthy of Walden Green Energy. So, David, you know, this project was originally rejected in a slightly different configuration. I think it was one of the turbines taken down, taken out of the plant.
Yeah, it was originally turned down because it was deemed aesthetically inappropriate for the ridgeline there in the Monadnock region. And so they came back with another project with lower towers and different designs and fewer towers. And this time it passed. It's hardly something you could interpret as now opening the floodgates for wind power in the state, because if I'm a wind developer, I look at that and say, okay,
no,
it took 8 years.
I've talked to somebody who said, you know, with this project, one reason it's significant because, you know, kind of if not that, what could have passed?
Yes, it's the only significant energy development project that has been approved in recent years, and the Wind Action organization and other wind opponents have already said they're considering a legal challenge. So it's not even over yet. And you can safely assume or reasonably assume, for instance, that if Northern Pass is approved by the Site Evaluation Committee, that it will face a legal challenge as well. So it ain't over till it's over.
Well, I think that's a safe bet there. And that is also ever the case on another topic, and that is education funding here in New Hampshire. There was certainly grumbling out of Berlin this week that that you know legal action might come from there over the ending of the sort of stabilization grants that were supposed to ease transition. And you know, Berlin's a community where you've got a shrinking school population, Casey.
Yeah, the mayor was on Morning Edition on NHPR earlier this week, just kind of outlining how these cuts have affected his community. He described them as brutal, I think the word he used. They're anticipating losses of about $219,000, excuse me, a year over the next 25 years as the state scales back the funding that it's providing to cities and towns under this new formula. And basically what the mayor was saying up there is that this is, A, resulting in more cuts to the school system in terms of the programming that they're able to offer, staffing, things like that. But then that also is part of kind of a larger cycle where once they diminish what they're able to offer in the school district, that makes Berlin a less attractive place for people to come and move, which further kind of devalues the tax base that they have. So it's really kind of, you know, it has a lot of consequences long term beyond just the immediate impact that it has on schools' bottom line.
All right, why don't we go to the phones? Elsa's on the line from Antrim. Good morning, Elsa. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I have been against the wind farm from the beginning in Antrim. I live in Antrim for 33 years, about a mile and a quarter from the wind farm. And I was at both sets of hearings. The first time, the project was turned down on aesthetics for the town of Antrim. And they never even got to financials, but they did say, oh, you know, we're not sure about their financials, they're shaky. This time, it was obvious to me that Maggie Hassan handpicked the SEC board to say, get this through, because they heard lots of testimony. A, there's been a study in Canada that says that people living within a mile and a half of wind farms, and these are smaller wind farms than this one, experience 70%, I can't remember the percentage, but a lot of people experience migraines and dizziness. And this project is going to affect quite a few people in the interim in terms of health. Because
so, Elsa, are you in favor of taking legal action on this?
Yes, I am. We are going to appeal this. It's not going to go smoothly for Jack.
All right. Well, thank you. I guess, you know, shape of things to come, and good luck with the headache should that occur. Want to go to a comment we have received on Twitter, which is says, cautionary. Now, be careful when it comes to deducing policy from campaign promises. That's in the context we're talking about Governor-elect Sununu. In Concord or D.C., FDR's big pledge in 1932 was balancing the budget. Off the top of my head, I don't know if that's true. I do recall George W. Bush promising a humble foreign policy. So, you know, good advice. Yes, no new taxes from his dad. Yes. So good advice all around. Thank you for the tweet. You know, so I guess the wind farm and from the fight will continue. You know, before we go, I just want to quickly talk about you know, a story this week. Something we covered in this story in the past was the resolution of the sort of rape shield issue in the context of the Seth Mazalia trial, and the Supreme Court ruled on that this week, didn't they, Ella?
Yes, yeah, so they ruled against Mazalia and his defense team. Their argument that his victim Lizzie Marriott's own sexual history should be evidence used.
A new trial.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So that issue, you know, is settled for now. His team could still appeal it further, but certainly, I think as they've been pretty consistently shot down by courts. I think much to the relief of Marriott's family.
Okay, and so we're getting towards the end of the show. What's everyone going to be focusing on next week as we kind of roll into the final lull before things get busy for all of us at the State House?
Well, Monday, the outside agency that's been studying the conditions at the Division for Children, Youth, and Families will release its full report, and that's expected to be quite a scathing indictment of the state of Child Protective Services in New Hampshire. as evidenced by some recent fatalities, the complexity that's been injected by the opioid epidemic. So we're very anxious to see what that report says. And, of course, responding to it will be a big part of the legislative activity in the year ahead.
Yeah. Ella, what about you?
So in another not very light topic, so one of my colleagues and I are starting to take a look at methamphetamine use in New Hampshire, which is something that I think has been overshadowed by the opioid crisis.
Is it up?
It is, at least in certain cities. We're going to be taking a little bit of a look at that.
I will probably continue to be keeping an eye on what kind of changes we can expect in the year ahead around voting rights and voting laws in New Hampshire, just kind of looking at some of the proposals that have been filed that will either revive or kind of old debates or you know, bring up kind of new proposals in the next legislative session.
Okay. And before we go, I just wanted to say anyone who's been paying attention to social media that touches on New Hampshire politics over the past few days has seen a steady stream of photographs of longtime AP photographer Jim Cole in various states of hairiness, sort of on the campaign trail at news conferences. Jim has been covering the news of all sorts in New Hampshire here for a very long time. He was laid off last week by the Associated Press. A friend to all reporters and a friend to the public in terms of all the coverage he's provided, stories of all types. So best to you, Jim. And best everyone as they head into the weekend. This is NHPR's Weekly News Roundup. I'm Josh Rogers.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.